So do you hear about this story that the New York Times is about to break?
The alien invasion is beginning?
No. I'm serious.
Oh.
So Trump told Comey whom to indict.
Yeah?
Kidding.
Yeah. You know what? Nothing shocks us anymore. Did you notice what a
this wouldn't
reaction
surprise me at all.
Yeah.
Like, really? And did he say indict me? Because that sounded entirely perfect.
I
did it. I'm the one. Indict me.
I shut
as, like,
the
a made clerk. Up, as a made-up shocking news story, like, that doesn't even come out. So I have to be like, did you hear, like, Trump has Minotaurs chained in the basement that he is gonna sick on people. Like, I don't know.
At this point, nothing would shock me.
Like, that's, yeah.
We are beyond shock. That's what this is. This is like the eighth phase of, like, whatever, of dealing with trauma. It's
yeah, we need
shock.
To, like, rewrite the cycles of grief for the stages of grief.
That's where this is the new one. Hello, and welcome to Rational Security, the Chatterbox in Chief edition. I'm Shane Harris of the Wall Street Journal, here in the Jungle Studio, where the air conditioning in this building has ceased, apparently, but it's nice and cool in here.
It's kind of barely working.
It's getting hot in here. It's getting hot in Washington.
Steamy.
The temperature is keeping pace with the rising tension that has overtaken the city.
All the increased blood pressure of all the people in the city has just raised the ambient temperature.
The process of becoming the dog in that fire cartoon is just, like, accelerating.
I did not think that this week I would say, looking back on last week, you ain't seen nothing yet.
So I got into an Uber this morning. And the very foreign driver said in some indiscernible accent, it's going to be very hot today. And I said, yeah, in so many ways.
Yeah.
And he said, did you understand me? I meant the weather. And I said, I know.
All right. Well, I am here in the Jungle Studio, as I said, with my friends Ben Wittes, Tamara Kaufman-Wittes, and Susan Hennessy. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Yeah.
Hey.
Another slow news week to get to.
Yeah, nothing going on.
This
language is really,
podcast.
It's really the episode you can miss.
Skip ahead in your feed. You
know, even I am drinking this week. That's where we are right now.
You know, Tammy this week did not have scotch, but she did have bourbon.
There you go.
Susan's still abstaining, though.
I have to go on national television in an hour.
Oh, and what is this?
Well, and I'm leaving here and meeting with a bunch of members of Congress, so I figure I should get good and drunk first.
All right, this week on the podcast, President Trump lets the Russians in on a little secret. Jim Comey has been taking notes of his meetings with the president. And what do this week's extraordinary events tell us about where we are on this ever-unfolding national drama? And
nowhere
are we any closer
good.
To an end? let's start with, I can't even say the big news of the week, because where do you begin? Let's start with the Washington Post's report this week that last week, the day after President Trump dismissed Jim Comey as the FBI director, he was meeting with Sergey Lavrov and Sergey Kislyak, the Russian foreign minister and ambassador in the Oval
inevitable
Office.
Sergey Kislyak.
The inevitable Sergey Kislyak?
Yes.
Sergey the Hutt.
The most effective intelligence agent in
the
modern
Russians
history.
Have ever had. And he's not even trying that hard. There's an Oval Office meeting. The subject turns to the threat against commercial airliners and ISIS trying to slip explosives onto them, which is not any big secret. But President Trump starts wading into information that some people in the room realize is coming from this very privileged source that we're getting from another country, which eventually gets disclosed to be Israel. Some notes of the meeting are written up. People in the White House are told about this, and eventually it's gets out that the president was essentially piercing the veil, if you will, around the secrecy of this information, which was shared with us by Israel and was certainly a breach of protocol and now raises all kinds of questions about whether it damaged the source, did it damage the intelligence relationship. Let's just start with the first order question, right? How bad is this? You know, Ben, you all at Lawfare wrote quite a bit extensively on how bad you think it is. That was a few days ago. I don't know if time has tempered your opinion, but give us a sense of just, you know, how significant it is that the president did this.
Well, so those are actually two separate questions. And what I would defer to Susan on a damage assessment, because I think her experience on the sort of what tea leaves you can read about how damaging this is certainly more significant than mine.
It's super fucking bad, Ben. Oh. Thanks for asking.
Okay.
SFB.
That's a technical term, right?
That's the official term for it.
But the second question you asked, which is like, how bad is it that the president did this, is not actually a technical intelligence judgment. It's a, you know, analysis of presidential sanity judgment and presidential action judgment.
Because he has the authority to declassify whatever he wants.
Right. No, no. But it. But I mean, even if it's only as a technical matter, X bad rather than 100X bad, there's a separate question of how bad it is that the president would accidentally, you know, dish to Russian operatives and diplomats, whatever they are, about, you know, highly sensitive intelligence. And the answer to that is that it's an immense breach of faith with the men and women of the American intelligence community. And it's also an immense breach of faith with our foreign intelligence partners, both the individual partner that was at issue here, which appears to be the Israelis, but also all the other partners who rely on the discretion of the American intelligence community as the sort of coordinator of a much larger intelligence effort. And all of that relies on the fact that our intelligence community is trustworthy, which in turn relies in a systematic way on the idea that the president is trustworthy. And even if you say this is a 4 or 5 on a scale of bad as a technical matter, it's still a 10 on the scale of bad presidential conduct.
Well, yeah. I think there's also, before we get to the technical question, which I think is highly relevant as well, there is a judgment question, even if you take the president at his word in his tweets the following morning about why he said he did this. Because, of course, after the fact, after the story broke, he claimed that he had done it to purpose in order to enlist the Russians in greater cooperation in fighting ISIS. But even if you take that at face value and accept that it's true, there's still a judgment question about this. Does it make sense to share it with the Russians before you share it with your European partners who are also subjects of this threat? Does it make sense to share it with the Russians without consulting the partner who gave you the intelligence or other partners who were affected by the threat? So even in the best case scenario, it is still a breach of faith with those allies, and it's still something that raises serious questions about the president's judgment. Now, when you put it in the context of the Washington Post reporting, which is that he gave them this information not in the course of making some kind of argument to them, but in a boastful way, hey, I get such great intel. Let me tell you about this example.
Hey, babes, want to see my intel?
Yeah, right. So it suggests that there's no policy directive there at all behind this, that it's really just a question of impulse. And, you know, that goes to the character issue. It's not a policy judgment. It's not a strategic judgment. It's not a question of sequencing. It's a character flaw that this guy simply cannot keep it zipped. And so whether it's an intel secret or anything else, you have to worry about impulsivity.
Yeah, so I do think it's going to be, there are these two questions, right, of how bad is it in terms of the damage assessment, and then what does it say in terms of sort of a larger judgment? Not all classified information is the same. Not all top secret information is the same. And so immediately after the story, I was sort of expecting the counter story to be, well, it wasn't really that critical of intelligence, or he mentioned something, but this was overblown by the sources. It actually wasn't that sensitive. Actually, everything that has come out since then has been an indicator that this is actually intelligence that is far more significant than was even represented in that original Washington Post story.
Okay, mm-hmm. So walk us through that, Susan. What's the... what are the indicia of particular sensitivity here?
Right. So first of all, we have the initial reaction of Trump's staff. So this is what sort of puts the lie to H.R. McMaster's representation of everything was totally appropriate. You know, he talked about only things that were okay. The account is that the staff immediately and rapidly recognized that this was a serious problem, called the NSA, called the CIA, started putting sort of damage control in motion. The notion that it is the reports that it is Israeli intelligence also makes it a particularly damaging and consequential breach, considering the importance of that intelligence sharing relationship.
And why is that relationship? I mean, Israel is a close ally, but we have a lot of close allies. Why is that intelligence relationship of particular significance?
Because different countries, no country has insight into everything everywhere, and different countries have different degrees of sort of regional penetration or capacity. And so whenever you think about partners like the Israelis and the intelligence information they might be able to produce that other countries aren't able to, or certainly no other countries that our intelligence sharing allies are able to, paired with their willingness to not share intelligence, right? So if this was a country where it really was a highly asymmetrical relationship in which, you know, yeah, the U.S. depends on them for a little bit, but they depend on the United States for a whole lot more. So their ability to sort of retaliate somehow is limited. No, we depend on the Israelis quite a bit. It doesn't mean they don't need us for anything, but this is a more complex situation. Plus, there's now news reports out of the Israeli press that people are furious that this has compromised really, really significant sources. The other thing that is sort of the clearest indication that this was really valuable intelligence is this was a source that produced actionable intelligence about a threat to aviation. So actionable that the United States actually stopped allowing laptops on certain flights into the country. So sort of putting all these things together, paired with comments from U.S. officials, including current U.S. officials, it is to me painting a picture that the information that was disclosed as just a practical matter could have very significant consequences.
Can I ask a question about one dimension of the reporting around this issue that I found really interesting? So, you know, the president let slip this information, and it was troubling enough that it, you know, the fact that this happened got leaked to the press, and the press immediately started digging into what happened and what the information was and where it came from and so on. In the course of all of that reporting, which is the media doing its job, many more details about the nature of this information and its source and what the implications of blowing it mean have been publicly reported. And so obviously this was all kicked off by a presidential indiscretion. But the result is a huge amount of public disclosure of information that it would seem to me, would compound the damage of this intelligence leak. Am I getting that right?
Well, that's what they call in the intelligence business the mosaic, right? You release one tile of the mosaic and then, you know, there are these other pieces that make up a picture, and you get that's why they don't like to release individual components, because it leads to the disclosure of additional
I've been thinking a lot about this, in part because we've been reporting on it, obviously. So I've been
had to make judgments about what to report and what
to
report.
Yeah, I mean, like, for instance, we knew that it was Israel the night that the story in the Post broke. We confirmed that with our sources, and we made a judgment call not to report it after, you know, the administration and the, you know, intelligence officials asked us not to report that. And we were transparent about that in the paper. And ultimately did report it after the Times reported it, because it was sort of out in the world, and what are you going to do about that? But what I found interesting is in talking to people in the government, that very point keeps coming up, which is, so it's almost like, not to say that they're blaming the press for putting this out there. It's more of a question of, well, you know, it shouldn't, it came up in the Oval Office, it became an issue, it somehow leaked out as more and more people found out about this. But what the administration line has been is trying to combat this by saying the media is overblowing it, right? That it wasn't actually that significant of an event. Of course, if that's the case, then why were we getting pushback on don't report details about it? You might jeopardize ongoing operations, et cetera. You can't really square those things. But one official I've talked to at pretty great length about this had a very interesting point, which was that actually, he felt that if you really wanted to see where the most, not so much incriminating, but revealing information has come out around this issue, it's actually been in the news reporting of a couple of weeks ago, particularly in CNN, about the intelligence threats against airliners and the steps that the government was taking, which strongly suggests that there was already information leaking out from this source via other means, not necessarily the president, before any of us knew that he talked about it with the Russians.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that speaks to a general carelessness with classified information. If we go back to think about how that initial reporting came out, in terms of the laptop question, there was this decision without any sort of context or information, not even the color-coded, like, you know, orange, red, whatever of the Bush years, just laptops are banned, no explanation, terrible public communication, tons of criticism into the White House of and DHS of this is not how you do things. Then all of a sudden we have press reports popping up about, you know, there's this bomb threat against ISIS. Now, this is speculative, but I think it's plausible that the leaks were White House leaks as damage control of some sort. Those are, it would be very unusual for the intelligence community, and considering their reaction here, to be the source of that kind of information. And so, look, I think there are lots and lots of indicia here of a White House that just is not careful with this stuff, and has been not careful with it in lots of different ways, from the Mar-a-Lago dining room to, you know, to their interactions with the press, to the people they hire, and that this is now they finally have crossed a line where that's all sort of come to a head.
Well, along those lines, you also had the very interesting case of White House officials coming out and defending the president's actions by saying, don't worry, he's not briefed enough in depth on things that he probably couldn't have revealed anything that important anyway, which was this super awkward moment.
So reassuring.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, because, you know, the Trump is getting ready to go on this, his first foreign trip, and it's a huge one. He's going to Saudi Arabia, Israel, and to Vatican City. The first stop is Riyadh, then he's on to Israel. So what's that like? As, you know, here we are with it now out in the open that we've got this great source of information. There's some level of consternation in Israel over this. Not that Trump has had any kind of the fraught relationship with Netanyahu that Obama did, but what does the scene look like as he gets ready to touch down there?
Okay, so first of all, this is a 9-day trip. He's going to Riyadh, Jerusalem, Bethlehem, the Vatican. Then he's going to Brussels for a NATO summit. Then he's going to Italy for a G7 meeting. So he's basically hitting a lot of major alliance relationships in one long trip, and several of them in multilateral groupings. And so when he lands in Riyadh, he's meeting, of course, with the Saudis and the Emiratis and Jordanians and other major partners. But the Saudis have invited 50-something, I think 56 Muslim-majority nations to come to this summit on combating violent extremism. Many of these countries, you know, have very different kinds of relationships with the United States, certainly not necessarily the same track record of trust. And I think Trump was hoping with this trip to get more commitments out of his partners in the region for their help in the fight against ISIS. And I think that this intelligence leak is going to cast a pall over that. With the Israelis, of course, you have anger over the leak. You also have a lot of anxiety about other dimensions of Trump's policy with regard to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, whether Trump recognizes Israeli sovereignty in Jerusalem. The administration's just announced, according to Bloomberg, that they are not, in fact, going to move the embassy to Jerusalem in June when the latest waiver expires. So I think in some ways, it's those policy things that will overshadow this intelligence leak in public on his Israel stop. But behind the scenes, I have no doubt it's going to constrain the way the Israelis engage. And then when you think about the NATO summit, you know, these are our Five Eyes partners, other major partners. I can imagine them all sitting around the table and nobody wants to say anything.
But that's what I was wondering. Is there a moment where, you know, privately they look at Trump and they go, dude, come on, what are you doing? Or is it just nobody addresses the issue, and it's just incredibly tense.
Yeah, well, I think the latter, and I also think that there may be information they have that they're going to be disinclined to share, knowing that it may go straight to Moscow.
And Tehran.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and remember, this confirms, that, yeah. you know, those early reports out of Israeli press about Israeli officials being worried about this precise thing.
Right. Right. All right. Let's move on to the other OMG of the week. So the New York Times reported on Tuesday. Right? Tuesday? What day is this?
Yeah, I'd just like to say we don't know it's the only other OMG of the week because it's only Wednesday.
It's only Wednesday.
And I actually want to say that by the time this airs, there may have already been another one.
Yeah.
And if there isn't another one by the time you hear this, there will be another one soon.
Yeah. OBE, as we say in the trade, overtaken by events. So it turns out that in all of these times when Jim Comey met with President Trump before he fired him, Jim Comey went back to the office and wrote detailed memos about what he and the president discussed.
Which, if you know Comey, is completely unsurprising.
Right.
It's kind of his thing.
Right.
Well, but it's also exactly the kind of thing that you do if, for example, you have a boss who makes suggestive comments. Your lawyer for your sexual harassment suit will tell you to document them
everything.
With memos in real time.
Right.
Or if you have an employee that you suspect is stealing from the company till,
and actually,
your HR department will tell you to keep memos in real time.
And if you think you have a boss who's obstructing justice, right. you might write a memo.
So this is actually, if you are listening to Rational Security, and your boss, who is a law enforcement officer of any kind, but particularly maybe a chief law enforcement officer of any kind, let alone the chief law enforcement, if your boss asks you to drop an investigation of a friend of his, and that investigation may involve the boss, write a memo. Actually, write down exactly what happened and make sure several people of your close acquaintance have access to it in case anything happens to you. That's just good thinking. That's not, you know, bureaucratic machinations. It's actually not, there's nothing inappropriate about it.
That's not even a pro tip. That's right. Just, you should do that.
That's an amateur tip. Just write a memo. Saying,
so let's talk about
this
memo.
But this gets to this very strange response.
Clear. Hold on, just we're clear. We're talking about the memo Jim Comey wrote after President Trump asked him to back off Mike Flynn.
One of them.
In case you've been under several rocks this week. Go ahead, Susan.
I guess you've drunk yourself blind. And you're just under the desk.
And if you haven't.
I guess you have gouged out your ears.
But I think there's sort of this, I mean, we're laughing about it, but it does, you know, the White House is sort of pushing back, or Trump surrogates are sort of pushing back as though, oh, you know, Jim Comey was being vindictive or petty. I think Jason Miller said, how weird and vindictive for him to keep a little diary. Actually, think about the position that Comey
was in. All people
in
government take notes.
Yeah, so first of all, the memorandum for the record is not a diary, but instead an obligation of the job. The second is, you know, think about the position that Comey's in. And I think it colors the way we should understand Trump's conduct, which is that you have these really strange interactions that are so contrary to sort of basic norms of the way your job is supposed to interact with another person's job whenever you're discharging really important offices, that it's hard to even say this is the obstruction of justice, right? I hope you can find your way to see yourself, see, you know, clearing Flynn or however he phrased it. I think it almost offers some insight into Comey's thinking, which is, you know, you start to document a course of conduct. And I think whenever we start to think about whether or not this was obstruction, it's not going to be holding up a single thing of this, you know, you fired this person and you did this or you did that. It's going to be this cumulative thing of a course of conduct over 3 or 4 months that is going to be the basis of making that kind of judgment ultimately.
I think that's exactly right. And I think an additional element is that if you're Jim Comey in that situation, and remember that incident on the public record did not occur in a vacuum. We know that The month before that incident, he had been asked to pledge loyalty to this man, and that he refused. We know that Reince Priebus had contacted his deputy on an active investigative matter. We know that there were some additional phone calls. We also know that at the end of the day, Trump fired him. And so I think that you can say, just on the public record, there is a highly suggestive pattern of activity. And I think we can assume that that is not an exhaustive list of the incidents that may have caused a reasonable FBI director under the circumstances to document his interactions with the president.
I mean, in fact, we report in the Times report, there are other memos. Yes. I mean, he did this on multiple occasions.
Right. And it is, you know, remember that in the whole hospital room scene story in the 2004 era, Comey documented things then as well. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is a practice of his that is, by the way, you know, good hygiene. And if you happen to think that you're dealing with highly dishonorable people, and this is a group of highly dishonorable people, documenting everything you do and everything that's said is just good sense.
The other thing is, look, let's take ourselves back to what feels like a million years ago, but was actually last week when we recorded an episode after Comey had been fired. We were discussing whether or not this was a pretextual, you know, the Rosenstein memo was just pretext and it really was. And well, if it was the Russian investigation, but can you prove that? In the period since that time, President Trump has gone on television and said, yeah, no, I was going to fire him no matter what, even if it had nothing to do with the Rosenstein memo. And two, I had the Russia investigation in mind when I took that particular action. He has obliterated the pretext and admitted.
Along with Rod Rosenstein's credibility.
Exactly. I think it speaks to how sort of mind-boggling and disorienting this all is, and that we've already, you know, originally we thought sort of the issue was going to be, how do you establish the real reason versus the pretextual reason? Now he's just given us the real reason.
Well, maybe this is evidence that he's learned the lesson of Nixon and Watergate, where it's not the crime, it's the cover-up. So, all right, let's just throw the cover-up to the side.
Let's dispense with the cover-up.
I'm going to be completely brazen about what I've done, and I dare you to make an issue out of it.
Right, so actually, I actually think there's an element. You're joking, but I actually think there's an element of truth to that, which is that there's a whole bunch of things, you know, that if you do covertly are a cover up, and if you do overtly are, you know, people don't notice, like,
well, especially
collusion with the Russians. You know, for example, look, if you, you know, make a secret deal to, like, I'm going to, you know, you're going to hack the election and I'm going to, you know, do X, Y, and Z for you and praise Vladimir Putin. And then, you know, people say, well, you're colluding with the Russians and that's a conspiracy and there's something off. But if you just do it completely in the public realm, the Russians hack the election and you praise Vladimir Putin, deny that they're doing it, say it could be a 400-pound guy on a bed. Why is he obsessed with the weight of the hacker?
And then invite them into the Oval Office.
And then invite them into office and give them highly classified information. Then people don't seem to mind nearly as much.
Or at least they don't know how to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is an interesting, it's an interesting question. Of course, it's also that, you know, people have become inured to outrageous behavior from this particular figure. And so the bar gets higher every time for that behavior to trigger a shock, a response of shock.
Right. Well, this is exactly, I think this gets to sort of what we were going to talk about in the third segment.
Right, it does. Let's segue to that.
What this really is about. Yeah. Congress's tolerance level.
But before we get to Congress's tolerance level, before we shift to that third segment, I just want to tie the first and second segments together for a minute, because yes, there's a distinction between them and it's important to keep them separate. But it's also important to say that on successive days, the president of the United States fired the FBI director for reasons he later said were because he was annoyed about the Russia investigation, and then went into the Oval Office and dished highly classified information that betrayed a U.S. ally and an allied foreign intelligence service to Sergei Kislyak. And I, you know, those are uncontested facts. And I do think it is worth just pausing a moment over the unified field theory of segment one and segment two.
But the unified field theory is he breached his oath of office. In one way, he breached his oath of office in a manner that didn't have underlying potential criminal violations. And in the other context, he breached his oath of office in a way that did have underlying criminal
even if there aren't criminal components of that, I do think the breach of the oath of office on the facts as we understand them is breathtaking. And I think it's worth the reason we're all having trouble sleeping at night, at least I am, the reason the day drinking in Washington has gone through the roof, the reason people are walking around greeting each other with words like, what the fuck? And how are you holding up? And the reason people like Shane have not shaved today is
I like it, actually.
I'm just a slob.
Is that there's a
little shadow.
You know, there is a breathtaking breach of the president's oath of office that is staring us in the face, or a series of breaches that ties together the set of things we were discussing in segment one and segment two.
But so can I just take a step back even from that, although I will pause to say that I love Shane's rough and ready look.
Thanks. Thanks, Tam.
I think staying up all night is great for
it
you.
It really suits you, Shane.
It is also a public service, and we appreciate
it. It's great for my health.
Joe loves it, too.
But really what these behaviors have in common is the man who exhibited them, Donald Trump. And what the last week has revealed to such an extent that even congressional Republicans are now having trouble looking away from it is that this is who Donald Trump is. He is careless about the responsibilities of his office. He's careless about international relationships. He's fixated on his own rights, as he put them in his tweet about the intelligence sharing with Russia. He's fixated on his own power and his own prestige. You know, the reporting that aides put his name into paragraphs of papers that are going to him so that he'll keep reading. This is who he is. People who have been saying he'll settle down, he'll learn on the job, can no longer look away from this. People who've been saying this is all an act to win the election and he's actually a really smart guy cannot look away from this. And I think that what's really happened this week is that it's just pulled back the curtain from a whole lot of people who have been desperately trying to maintain a sense of normalcy and a degree of denial about the nature of the man who's president of the United States. Now, does that motivate them to act? That's the question I think that's before us.
Which brings us to Congress.
Right. Well, I think this actually, it ties into sort of to bring both of the first two and the third together, right, to tie them in like a nice bow for our listeners because we care about you. This notion of the secrecy, and I think we're so conditioned for the idea that a story breaks, it's shocking, it's the front page news, and then something happens. And when nothing happens, and in this case, the nothing happening is Congress not doing anything, not taking action, all of a sudden it becomes normal, right? Your ability to go back and say that's unacceptable whenever you've tolerated it for a period of time, you undercut yourself. You undercut yourself in precisely the same way that Donald Trump undercut himself by saying 5 months after Jim Comey had been his FBI director, I'm mad about something he did 8 months ago, right? That whenever something has not been a problem or you haven't thought it warranted this really significant response, it makes it much harder for you to undertake the response. Think about all the momentum going against impeachment for a Republican-controlled Congress. If they don't start taking action rapidly in response to this stuff, I start to wonder what possible information could come out that would cause them to do something.
Well, that's what I really want to get you guys' thoughts on quickly before we wrap up. But, I mean, we have seen a series of events that extraordinary doesn't even capture what has happened here. I don't think we've ever seen anything like this sequence of events, certainly in modern political history. There is a kind of a sustained quality of chaos right now to both our politics, to the administration. Is there a breaking point in this, or is it simply that this is now just kind of, you know, the new normal is the wrong phrase, but is this...
It's the new abnormal.
Well, it's a new, but it's an environment in which clearly Donald Trump, to a certain extent, thrives and survives. I mean, he is surviving this, which I think is probably the most notable thing to happen, where these are, I think, you know... It seems to me like these are things that are, you know, actions that would probably undo most people. So, I mean, do you think this is just something that we're going to tolerate? Is there a breaking point in this?
So, first of all, I think it's wrong to say that he's surviving this. It may turn out that he's surviving this, but we'll only know that when we know that he either has or hasn't.
Right.
And I think, you know, we don't know what inning of the game we're in.
Right.
And right. And I think it's reasonable. Look, if we're in the second inning and...
I'm sorry. It could get worse from this. No. I mean, that's what this conversation
Take
is. It could
in.
Get a lot worse than
this. It's not that's necessarily that those extra innings mean that more horrible news is going to break, though.
So, look, the point is you could imagine it being a long, drawn-out death from cancer, right? You could also imagine it being a short acute illness that looks like it might turn into a long drawn out death of cancer, but that the system eventually, the immune system kicks in and kicks in hard when it kicks in. And I think until you know what the etiology of the disease is, it is wrong to say he's surviving this. I think the key question is, and I'm not a political scientist, let alone an Americanist political scientist, which is a species that I'm not terribly sympathetic to. But is what does the median Republican member of Congress, how do they assess their threat matrix politically? And is that, and at what point, if any, do they either as a matter of patriotism or as a matter of fear of their voters, fear a general election voter more than a primary
election voter. Well, it seems like they're looking for the third option, which is that there's still a way to salvage this, fire your staff, get it under control, you know, take control. Mr. Corker saying this. I mean, they still feel like there's an opportunity to get back to what Republicans in Congress would say is a normal administration,
right,
which I personally think
he's
is
totally
misguided.
He's going to change this time.
He's not going to change.
So the question is, like, what are their priorities? There's been some good news reporting on this, I think, over the last few days that have advanced kind of alternative hypotheses of what it is members of Congress are prioritizing and what it might take for them to start to flip in the way that you're describing, Ben. You know, for some of them, it's about the legislative agenda. For some of them, it is about valuing the base over the general election voter. And therefore, you know, they want to get through 2018 before they make a call on whether this guy is good or bad for their future. And if that's the case, then, you know, we are talking about a long period of continued chaos in policymaking, chaos in the process of the White House and the executive branch. Chaos in our relation in America's relationships abroad, and that's not something that a staff change is going to manage, and it's not something that can be learned out of. And as you said, Shane, it's an environment in which President Trump seems to thrive and even enjoy himself. So I think if we're going on the assumption that it's the electoral calculation that matters and that congressional Republicans are more worried about their base than they are about the center, then I think we all need to buckle in and be ready to just live through this until the midterms.
I just have one thing to add to that, which is, you know, if Mitch McConnell, who said he wants to see a little bit less drama, thinks that you can reduce the drama level with a staff change. He's kidding himself. The problem is not the staff. The problem is not Rex Priebus. The problem is not even Steve Bannon. The problem is Donald Trump. And the problem is that we have a mercurial, not very intelligent, vindictive president with a severe impulse control problem. And that is a completely toxic and who entirely lacks a moral compass. And you put those things together, and that is not a remediable problem with staff changes. It's not a remediable problem with organized process. It's a endemic character flaw in the person who embodies the executive branch of the United States. And you just have to decide how you feel about that.
All right. Let's move on to object lessons.
On that cheerful note.
Do you want to go first?
I will go. I have a very quick one. It is a bottle of Three Howls Navy Strength Gin from Lawfare editor and rational security listener Nick Weaver, who heard our pleas for more booze of a more varied nature. And so
we support diversity.
We support diversity in our booze. And Nick has very kindly sent us this bottle, which we will now proceed to drink all of in the next hour.
I just want to add that a complete stranger to me sent me a bottle of Talisker, which Shane and I are...
That was also from a stranger?
That was... Well, Nick Weaver is by no means a stranger. But
so sent you a bottle of scotch, too.
Well, no. Before, a friend sent us a bottle of the Cask Strength.
Right.
Abelor was from a listener of the podcast whom I know very well and have actually written things with. But this was the first bottle that has shown up unsolicited, but from somebody who listens to the podcast and none of us has ever met. And so I just want to say, Steve, this is a huge shout out to you because you have set a trail that other rational security listeners should
way
follow.
Better than just a sponsorship.
Inundate us with booze.
Yeah, to hell with MeUndies. Send booze to Rational Security.
Did you check this bottle for listening devices?
I checked it.
Do you know Steve?
You just drank some of it. No, I've never met Steve.
Are you sure his name is not Sergey?
Steve Gay? Steve?
I don't know.
Steve Kislyak?
Steve, don't stop sending booze on my account. I'll do my object now. I am under attack in my garden.
What?
By birds. These little bastards. I saw them this morning. They were like this. They were, I don't even know what they were, finches, sparrows, I don't care.
Starlings.
Starlings?
Probably.
Savaging my mint plant. And you guys know how I feel about the
Your
garden.
Mint plant?
I have a mint plant. The mint plant will grow back. But I have, like, rational security listeners know I'm into the garden. It brings me peace. At one point, we talked about, like, growing poisons in it because of a security theme.
And instead, you planted radishes.
Well, I planted radishes, which you saw last week, which I'm, saving up for when we all have to live underground. But now I have got, like, a veritable vegetable garden on the deck. It's beautiful. It's all in containers. I've got, everything you could possibly want. And these little bastards are out there picking leaves off my shishito peppers, going after the eggplants, going after the mint. So I have implemented my own homeland security system. It is this.
Oh, the fake owl.
The fake owl. The fake owl is my sentinel.
Shane.
I don't know why he couldn't keep him away from the mint plants. We might need more.
Now, here's a question.
I'm sorry to tell you this, but the fake owl's efficacy decreases over time. They become inured to it, and they're going to start
eating your
stuff
again.
They've
learned your source and method, and it no longer is.
Maybe we
need that's right.
Should we put one in the Oval Office?
I'm just waiting to go out there and find him sitting there eating a tomato while sitting on the owl.
That will happen. And I think if you're really serious about keeping the food from your garden pristine, you're going to have to do bird netting.
All right. We'll see. Joe's going to be very disappointed because the owl was his idea. Joe's in charge of homeland perimeter defense.
I have a different prescription for this problem. A BB gun. Airsoft.
A sniper. Yeah. We put mirrors up to shoo them away with lights. But national security listeners, tell me how to defeat these birds. Tomorrow thinks netting.
I'm into denial.
Oh, okay. Well, Luckily, we have a lot of booze I can keep drinking when I lose my mint.
You could just put it in a bird feeder.
Lose your mint, lose your mind.
That's right. All right, that brings us to the end of the podcast this week. Rational Security is, of course, a production of Spaghetti on the Wall Productions. You can find links to the show archive at spaghettionthewallproductions.com. Find us on Facebook. What?
I just want to say, I went on to the iTunes store page for Rational Security. Yeah. You guys have been leaving the most awesome reviews.
Oh, good. Okay.
There are, and I'm actually going to print out a bunch of them and read them next week because some of them are seriously funny. And so
we have a witty listenership.
We do have a witty listenership, but we just got it. There's some great stuff on there. And so, you know, leave your rating this week. Write your review of Rational Security. Next week, we're going to have a little bit of a break from all that ails us, and we're going to read some reviews of Rational Security.
Then I will spare you from our normal plea and say thank you for leaving 5-star ratings and reviews. Follow us on Twitter at RATL Security. Our audio engineer is Quinta Jurassic.
But not this week.
But not this week. She's away. Your audio engineer this week has been Ben Wittes, so blame him. Our show is produced and edited by Jen Howell. Our music is performed this week by Jim Comey and the Dirty Diary. Right?
Not bad, not bad.
He's got a dirty diary.
He's got a dirty
diary, a vengeful diary. Of course, our music is performed as always by Sophia Yan, who, if she does keep a diary, is full of nothing but praise for this show and all the wonderful people in her charmed life.
That sounds bad.
And who has probably never obstructed justice.
Totally.
But only administered.
And if she did, would not write about it in her diary. On behalf of my good friend Susan Hennessy, Tamara Kaufman-Wittes, and Ben Wittes, I'm Shane Harris. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.